It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, according to new data out from a UW-Madison researcher, there's one thing that 9 out of 10 young men surveyed wish their doctors would ask them about. We'll find out what it is coming up. First, have you been gathering up the harvest from your garden? Got some nice tomatoes, green beans, peppers, watermelon, maybe some different kinds of berries? Even if your results are a bit shabby, like mine usually are, or you don't have a garden, there's always the grocery stores and farmers markets with lots of local produce. But what are you going to do with all that summer bounty? Our next guest has lots of ideas in this week's edition of Food Friday. Sonia Overheiser is the co-author, along with her husband Alex, of Pretty Simple Cooking, 100 delicious vegetarian recipes to make you fall in love with real food. They also blog at acouplecooks.com, where she writes and develops recipes. Sonia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
There are a lot of great foods in the summertime to look forward to. What do you get the most excited about this time of year?
Well, first off, I would say basil and my herb garden full of herbs. I have a huge bush right now outside in my backyard and have been making up all the delicious pesto and tomato basil soup and tomato basil everything. So I love basil in the summer. And of course, summer tomatoes, especially those beautiful heirloom tomatoes you can get at the farmer's market, or you can grow. Right now, squirrels have been eating most of my tomatoes, but the markets are full of beautiful multicolor tomatoes. And peaches are another one of my very favorites that are on right now, just juicy, delicious peaches. So I'm loving this time of year.
Let's talk about that basil a little bit, because I must admit, over many years, I have misused fresh herbs like basil and put them in at the beginning of the cooking process. Mm. And then many Food Friday guests have said, no, Rob, wait till the very end to keep that flavor. Is that what you tend to do as well?
Absolutely. So here's a thing to know about basil. Basil hates the heat. So if you put basil in that pan or in your oven on a pizza, it's going to turn black within a few minutes. So you want to add that right at the end. If you're making a beautiful pizza margarita, bake it up in the oven and then thin slice it, or just even tear it up and put it on right at the end. And then you'll be able to keep that beautiful bright green color.
And with making pestos out of basil, and you can use some other herbs too. I don't know, in my head, I used to think of it as this big chore, this big process. But if you have a blender, or I have a magic bullet or a food processor, it's pretty easy. Can you give us the basics of just, pulling together a quick pesto?
I can. I just did it today, actually. So get all those beautiful basil leaves, and then you're going to blend together basil with some garlic, Parmesan cheese. I like to put a little lemon juice to get a little zing in my pesto, and then nuts. And a tip I want to share with you is that the traditional basil pesto uses pine nuts, but those can be a little expensive. Some people don't love the flavor of those. So you can actually use any nuts you'd like. We love using cashews. That's what I used today. They have a great neutral flavor to use in your pesto, or you can use walnuts. And you can start experimenting too with different types of nuts. So don't feel like you have to go out and splurge on those expensive pine nuts to make pesto.
We're talking to Sonia Overheiser, co-author of the book Pretty Simple Cooking. We are talking about what to do with all the great summer produce out there right now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you look forward to cooking with and or eating in the summertime? Is there a favorite kind of produce, or do you have a lot of something and need some ideas on what to do with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. All right, Sonia, I took us on a basil detour there. Let's get to one of the recipes that you shared with us. I love this. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Easy eggplant pizza. And my first thought looking at this was, oh, I'm going to make a pizza. I'm going to put some eggplant on it. Wrong. Tell us about this one.
It is actually quite the opposite. So in this recipe, you will use eggplant as the crust for your pizza. So if you eat gluten-free, or you're cooking for people who do, or you just want to have a lighter option, it's really fun and really simple. All you do is slice your eggplant and roast those up, so they're little rounds, and then top it with your tomato sauce and cheese, and then some of that fresh basil that you add at just the right moment when it's done roasting. And they're so much fun. They're a really easy way to make pizza. You don't have to worry about making dough or waiting for a long time for your dough to proof. You can just throw them right in the oven and roast them up.
And you've got you do a lot with eggplants. I see on your website, I think you've got some grilled eggplant, you know, circles. Talk about grilling eggplant. I've done it a couple times, but tell us how it works.
Sure. So eggplant, interestingly, it really is a sponge for oil. If you've ever worked with it, it just sucks it right up. So we found with grilling your eggplant, you want to add that oil right at the last minute before you put them on the grill. And then you just grill them on medium high heat for as long as they take to tender up, probably about 6 to 8 minutes total, or about 10 minutes total. And yeah, they come out beautifully tender and a little bit smoky from the grill. They're fantastic.
Yeah, and I love the versatility because you could do, like you said, make a pizza. You can just eat it as is, or you can use it, I think I saw on your site, as, you know, the patty on a burger.
You can. There are so many different things that you can use it for. And another one that I'll mention is a grilled eggplant sandwich. You can also do it with a roasted eggplant. So if you don't have a grill, roasting is the way to go. It's incredible. It brings out an incredible flavor. And just throw some of that basil pesto that you made right onto that sandwich. We call it an Italian eggplant sandwich. And then use some of those beautiful ripe summer tomatoes. And then an olive spread, like a tapenade, you can get those easily at the store, or you can make your own with a food processor, and some fresh mozzarella cheese. It is amazing.
I want to check out another recipe. This is a great summertime one. I just had my first corn on the cob this year. I grilled it, but in a different way than you do. You sent us a recipe for a Mexican-style grilled corn. Again, we have this up at WPR.org/Food Friday. What is special about this way of grilling corn?
Yeah, so this is elote. It's a Mexican street food. It's the way that it's prepared in Mexico. And the way that we like to grill it is leaving on the corn husk. So you will pull the husk back and tie it so that when you grill it up, you have a built-in handle for your corn. And then you cover it in this beautiful sauce. That's creamy with sour cream. It's got some queso fresco or feta cheese mixed in there and some cumin and lime. So you've got all sorts of beautiful, savory, tangy flavors covering this corn. It is my hands down favorite way to eat corn in the summer.
I have never made corn that way. When I do it, I like boiled corn on the cob. And when I do it on the grill, I usually soak it and then leave, you know, just the inner layer of husk on. Does it get, it doesn't get too dried out when you're baking it without any husk still surrounding the corn?
No, it chars up just beautifully. So you're going to have to try that one. Get back to me on how you like that.
I definitely watch it. And actually the sauce is part of what's getting me in on this game. That sounds super good. That creamy sour cream cheese sauce looks fantastic.
Oh yeah. You'll want to put it on just about everything.
Now, this is a great thing to eat on its own. What would you pair that with if you wanted it as one, you know, portion of a meal?
Yeah, tacos.
Sure.
We have so many tacos recipes. If you go to our website, acouplecooks.com, we've got a taco for just about anything. There are vegetarian tacos, there are shrimp tacos, fish tacos, avocado tacos. We've got pretty much everything. So a fantastic summer meal is just tacos on the patio with some grilled corn. It's fantastic.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kimberly is with us in Fox Lake. Kimberly, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Kimberly?
So as you know, it's zucchini season now, and going out of zucchinis out of my ears right now. Is there any, like, suggestion besides just putting the zucchini in the oven with Parmesan or just adding it to stir fries? I just need ways to mass cook the zucchini.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for the call. And just so you know, Sonia, here in Wisconsin, there are running jokes about this time of year. Oh, somebody broke into my car. And what did they take? Nothing, but they left zucchini. What can you do to help Kimberly and the rest of us use all our zucchini up?
Sure. Well, I was wondering if this would come up. So I have a whole arsenal of ideas. What Kimberly mentioned, I love throwing it in the oven with some Parmesan. But actually, one of the latest things I did with it was to make a casserole. So like a zucchini and squash casserole. It's got a creamy sauce with a bit of Parmesan and then some crunchy breadcrumbs on top. It's kind of a lightened up version of the, you know, very, very heavy Southern style version of it. And it was incredible. A perfect side dish for any type of summer meal. So that's one idea, the squash and zucchini casserole. I love just pan frying zucchini. It comes out amazing. You'll be amazed at the flavor. So I have a great recipe for just pan fried zucchini with some parmesan. Some oregano and basil go really well with zucchini. And then another favorite idea for you, if you love baking, Kimberly, there's of course zucchini bread and zucchini muffins, but I really love a zucchini chocolate cake. So you just use that shredded zucchini to make a delicious and a little bit of a lighter spin on a chocolate cake because you use some almond butter and maple syrup and cocoa powder and you mix that all up with your zucchini and it makes it beautifully moist, gluten-free chocolate cake.
Fantastic. Kimberly, you got a lot to start with there. It is Food Friday. We're talking about what to do with our summer produce with Sonia Overhizer. She and her husband Alex wrote the book Pretty Simple Cooking, 100 delicious vegetarian recipes to make you fall in love with real food. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite dish to make with the stuff from your garden or your farmer's market or the local section at your grocery store? Do you need help on what to do with all the tomatoes, peppers, green beans, and the rest? Do you preserve any of your harvests so you can have them year-round? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our Food Friday conversation about cooking with our summer produce. Sonia Overhizer is with us, co-author of Pretty Simple Cooking, 100 delicious vegetarian recipes to make you fall in love with real food. We've posted three recipes that she shared using our summer harvest at WPR.org, a Mexican grilled corn, an easy eggplant pizza, and fresh berries with mint and vanilla whipped ice cream. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the favorite thing that you like to make using the bounty from your garden or from a nearby farm, say? Do you have a favorite way to use up the corn, tomatoes, cukes, raspberries, or other summer fruits and veggies? Or do you need some suggestions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Sandy is with us in Green Bay. Sandy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Sandy?
Well, first of all, I love jam. So that's what I do with all of my stuff. So I have jam everywhere, and that's what everybody gets from me. Would you like some jam? Here, have five. And then I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. But I just had a comment regarding a couple of things that Sonia talked about. One of them was regarding the pesto, and I actually was reading not too long ago that if you blanch your basil leaves, it actually keeps the basil tasting and looking fresher for longer. So it'll maintain that bright green color and that bright basil-y flavor for longer if you just blanch it real quick and then shock it in ice water and then proceed with your recipe.
That sounds great. Yeah. And I have the problem, Sonia. Thanks for that call, Sandy. I have the problem with, you know, basil still tasting good the next day, but it's, you know, it's not looking green anymore.
Right. And actually, I just made a sauce similar to that. So I blanched my basil and just made a basil sauce. So instead of adding the nuts and the cheese, you can just make a sauce with garlic and olive oil and basil. And if you blanch it, it stays this beautiful green color. And then it's perfect for drizzling over salmon or shrimp or even as a dip for bread. So that's another idea that you can do. But yeah, absolutely, it does. Blanching it, throwing it into boiling water for just 30 seconds does help to keep that bright green color too.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sandy, at 800-642-1234. Sandy also mentioned that she likes to make jam out of a lot of stuff. What are some of your favorite things when it comes to preserving in any form, Sonia, the summer produce?
Yeah, so my favorite is pickles. So Alex and I love to make pickles. out of lots of different things. So you can start with cucumbers and make a standard dill pickle. But we've also been getting creative. We've been doing pickled cauliflower. We do pickled jalapenos. We do pickled onions, even pickled radishes. So you can pickle so many different things. Usually we do the quick pickle method. So it's not technically preserving it to be shelf stable. It's preserving it for a month in your fridge. And we usually find that we eat it much faster than a month. So,
yeah, I do fridge pickle of a lot of things. Actually, I try to do beets all the time, and I've tried a bunch of different recipes and just haven't found the one that's as good as, you know, my grandma used to make or whatever. Any advice for making great fridge pickled beets?
That is a great question, and that's a good challenge. So I'm going to take that back to our drawing board, and we'll try to create one for you.
I'll look forward to it. If you come up with something, I'd sure appreciate it. Well, let's go
we'll
back
sure
to our callers.
Send it over.
Thanks. We'll go back to our callers. Steve is with us in Wausau. Steve, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the zucchini pie. The Pillsbury Bake-Off about 10 or 15 years ago won $50,000 prize, and I think they just change one ingredient, but it's made with the Pillsbury crescent rolls for the crust, and a lot of zucchini, a lot of butter, a lot of oregano, and it's just delicious. Everybody, my friend makes it, and every time she brings it, people ask for her to bring it again.
So it's a savory pie, it sounds like, Steve. Do I have that right?
Yes.
So it's not sweet like zucchini bread, and is the zucchini like grated up like you do in zucchini bread,
yes,
or is it
is.
Chunks of zucchini?
Yes. You have to grate it up, right?
Okay. That but sounds good. Interesting, Steve. Have you ever heard of that, Sonia? A zucchini pie.
I haven't, but no, I definitely want to taste that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. One of our producers here on Central Time reminds me of a chocolate zucchini cake that I made a couple years ago that I'd forgotten about, but I think I need to make that again. So, yeah, there's a lot of good creative things to do with our zucchini. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Sonia Overheiser, co-author of Pretty Simple Cooking, 100 Delicious Vegetarian Recipes to Make You Fall in Love with Real Food. We're talking about what to do with our summer produce. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. We've got one more recipe that I think you shared with us last time you were on. I wanted to talk about it. It is fresh berries with mint and vanilla whipped cream. I might have said ice cream earlier. I meant whipped cream. Sounds pretty simple and straightforward and yummy. Tell us about that.
It's so simple, and it's the best way to use summer fruit. I find that if you get your fruit and it's perfectly ripe, who wants to ruin it by cooking it down and putting it in a pie or in a baked good? You want to eat that delicious fruit how it is in its beautiful natural state. So we love just making a homemade whipped cream. So simple. You can use a whisk and a bowl and get a good workout, or you can also use a stand mixer and just whip it together with a little bit of powdered sugar and vanilla. And if you've never made your own homemade whipped cream, you have to try it. It's so much better than store-bought, and it's so easy. So it's a great way to just whip up something. And if you have guests, if you're having a distanced patio party, it's the perfect dessert.
We've got that recipe and a couple more, the eggplant pizza and the Mexican grilled corn, all up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Hey, getting back to pesto, Grant emailed us a suggestion. Be certain to toast any nut you choose to use in making pesto. Grant says night and day difference. Is that part of your pesto scheme sometimes, Sonia?
It is. Yeah. Toasting nuts really brings out the flavor. And I didn't mention it when I originally was walking through the steps because I had some already roasted nuts that I used today. But toasting really, really brings out the beautiful flavor in nuts, in any sort of nut. And if you're using nuts in a recipe, especially if you're putting them on top of that whipped cream with the berries, toasting them, you will 100% taste the difference between a raw nut and a toasted nut. It just takes a few minutes on the stovetop.
Thanks for the suggestion, Grant. Back to our callers now. Anna is with us in Janesville. Anna, hello.
Hello. My question actually is what to do with yellow squash. I have a whole bunch from my garden, and I don't want to just give it away. I want to be able to save some of it and use it later on. But if you freeze it, it gets mushy, and I'm just not really sure. Is there a way to can it? How do I save this to use it later on in the year?
Anna, thanks for the call. Now, regular listeners will have heard me talk about my favorite thing to do, which is a kind of fridge pickled zucchini relish, like grated up with onions and peppers and stuff. Your thoughts, Sonia, on preserving that yellow summer squash?
Wow, that sounds delicious. I love that idea.
I
would definitely use it that way. I have never preserved summer squash, so this is a great question. I've seen that you can blanch it and then freeze it, so I'm not sure if you've tried that before. So again, blanching is just throwing it into a pot of boiling water for a minute or two. So that could maybe help with the freezing situation.
Thanks a lot for the call. Hope that helps. Time for one more caller. Connie is with us in Appleton. Connie, hi.
Hi. One of the ways that I found to use zucchini is to grate it and add it to my pea or bean soup. It doesn't change the flavor a lot, but it's really delicious in there.
Interesting. So zucchini, do you have a zucchini soup thoughts, Sonia?
You know, I've never had zucchini soup, but I love that idea of adding kind of a bit of nutrients and texture to a thick bean soup or even a chili. That's a great idea.
Sounds good. Connie, in our last minute, Sonia, you made that basil earlier today. What is your next summer produce project?
Well, I think I'm headed to the farmer's market tomorrow to get all those beautiful tomatoes to make a few more tomato recipes. I have a great salsa that I always love to make. And then, of course, caprese salad. We just made a salad also with burrata cheese. So that's fresh mozzarella that's filled with cream. So if you put that on a plate and slice up some tomatoes and throw in a little basil, olive oil, and sea salt, it is an incredible treat.
That sounds fantastic. Sonia, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Sonia Overheiser is the co-author with her husband Alex of Pretty Simple Cooking, 100 delicious vegetarian recipes to make you fall in love with real food. They blog at acouplecooks.com. We talked to her today about what we can do with all that great summer produce out there. We've got three recipes that she shared posted at WPR.org/Food Friday, Mexican grilled corn, easy eggplant pizza, and fresh berries with mint and vanilla whipped cream. Give them a shot. Let us know how it goes. Coming up after the news, young men believe doctors should ask them regularly whether they've perpetrated or experienced domestic violence. That's according to a new study from a UW-Madison professor, our next guest after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the early years of the AIDS epidemic were marked by misinformation and fear, with some similarities to what we've seen with COVID-19. We'll hear from a former state representative about Wisconsin's public health action in the era of AIDS. First, at any doctor visit, no matter what brings you in, you often find yourself answering a number of questions, from mental health assessments to family health history. A new study conducted by a UW professor found that there's one more thing many men wish their doctors would ask about. 90% of the young men surveyed said they believe their doctors should ask about whether they have perpetrated or experienced intimate partner violence. Tova Walsh is an assistant professor of social work and an affiliate of the Center for Child and Family Well-Being and the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Tova, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Before we dig into the survey and its results, let's talk about the why of this a little bit. What got you interested in looking at the interaction between healthcare workers and young men when it came to issues of domestic violence or intimate partner violence?
Well, we know that intimate partner violence is a significant public health problem in the United States and around the world. And I think there's an opportunity in healthcare settings to be doing more to identify violence.
And in this survey, what were you asking young men and what did they have to say?
So in this survey, we asked young men, so men ages 18 to 35, about their experiences of violence in relationships. So whether they had been a victim of violence or perpetrated violence against a partner in a romantic relationship. We also asked them about whether they had ever been asked by a healthcare physician about violence in their relationships, and whether they thought that their doctors should ask them about violence in relationships. And what was really striking to us was that the vast majority of men believed that their doctors should be asking them about violence, but very few men had ever been asked. And so we think that's a pretty striking gap and suggests an opportunity to do more to identify violence and then to use what we learned to increase prevention.
What did you find out when you asked whether the men had experienced and or perpetrated domestic violence?
So we learned that about one-fifth of men reported perpetration. So 19% reported that they had committed violence in a relationship with a partner. And over a quarter, 27% reported being victimized in a relationship with a current or previous partner. So a pretty prevalent problem in our sample, which I should mention was nationally representative of young men across the country.
And so what could be the benefit of having that, you know, routine doctor visit for whatever, being a point of contact for issues of domestic violence?
So a healthcare screening or an assessment when you're in the context of a healthcare encounter is an opportunity for a clinician to ask in a non-judgmental and compassionate way about whether a person has ever experienced violence and then to use that relationship to get them connected to resources. So whether it's connecting them to services specifically for victims or connecting somebody to services that are focused on helping batterers to change their behavior, healthcare clinicians really have a special opportunity to do that since they're people who are often seen as kind of a resource, a trustworthy resource, and can communicate with their patients about ways of promoting their own health and the health of people in their families.
Now, you write that one concern with this as an intervention is younger men, are prone to be kind of healthy, maybe not need those routine visits, and also B, by choice, not go to a doctor's office as much. That might limit the impact of this kind of intervention. Do I have that right?
That's right. So we were concerned about that. But one thing we found that was a little surprising to us was that a majority of young men in our sample reported that they have a regular doctor. So 60% of young men in our sample have a doctor who they have a relationship with, and that suggests opportunity for screening.
Talking to Tova Walsh, Assistant Professor of Social Work and affiliate of the Center for Child and Family Wellbeing and the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison, looking at her research on young men, doctor's visits, and the questions from the doctor's office to screen them to see if they'd experienced domestic violence as a perpetrator, as a victim, or as both. And Tova, some part of your sample had been on both ends of domestic violence, potentially a cycle of violence in their experiences.
That's right. So actually, the majority of men who reported any experience with violence reported that they had experienced violence from both sides, that they had perpetrated violence and been the victim of violence.
Now, a lot of times when we talk about domestic violence or intimate partner violence, we talk about services for people who have been victimized by it. You see, if I'm reading your research correctly, that's a good thing, of course, but also that there's a lot of potential if we do more treatment and intervention for perpetrators or even potential perpetrators. What could that look like?
I think that's right. So, you know, definitely we've been more focused on identifying people who are experiencing violence and getting them connected to support. And that work is really critical. And it's really great that we've seen growth in that area. Where I think there's more room to grow is in identifying perpetration and using what we can learn about perpetration to increase primary prevention. So preventing violence before it occurs and changing the behavior of perpetrators or potential perpetrators of violence. What that could look like is a doctor asking an open-ended question of a patient, so starting with finding out whether they're in a relationship and then asking them if they and their partner are ever violent toward one another and figuring out if they say yes, whether that involves victimization or perpetration or both, and going from there to get them connected to appropriate resources. And, you know, research in other contexts suggests that when doctors ask those questions sensitively in a way that doesn't imply judgment, that people can be pretty forthcoming with their doctors and are open and receptive to receiving those resources.
Yeah, the results where so many, such an overwhelming majority of men said they'd be interested in seeing this as part of a screening suggests that men, even ones who had perpetrated domestic violence, wanted to have that conversation maybe with their doctor.
that was really striking to us, that even among those who had perpetrated violence, a large majority did want to be asked by their doctor. So they were slightly less likely than other men to endorse that belief, but still a vast majority, which suggests that there is really room for doctors to be asking. And we know that one of the barriers often to asking about violence is providers feeling uncomfortable asking those questions, perhaps thinking that they're going to make their patients uncomfortable or they don't want to be asked. So we hope that by getting the word out that, in fact, men are receptive to being asked, that that might increase comfort in asking these questions and initiating a conversation.
I know one concern with adding any kind of screening to a doctor's visit is that time is limited in many cases. Is there a concern that, well, this might be a good idea on top of the conversation about smoking or diet or exercise or all the other things that might be screened for, there might not be time for this conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is certainly a concern, is just thinking about the limited time in a clinical encounter and how can you ask about all of these things. But I think we can be, you know, inventive in how we approach this. So thinking about, you know, with what kind of frequency we ask these questions, or also that it doesn't always have to be you know, direct verbal questioning with the provider. It could be a questionnaire that's sent out in advance, like we sometimes receive, for example, about mental health, or with children's health care, we get questionnaires to fill out about the child's development. It could be done through writing or online.
So you've done this survey, you've released the research. What are you hoping happens now in a clinical setting? What are you hoping the healthcare profession does with this research?
So I hope the healthcare profession will increase asking about perpetration as well as victimization, and increase asking people regardless of gender. So I think it's really terrific and important that providers are more and more treating it as routine to ask women about experiences of violence. But I think being mindful that people of all genders experience violence, and being mindful that identification of perpetrators also offers a point of intervention is really critical. So I hope this will broaden our thinking about how we can effectively identify violence in healthcare settings and get people connected to services.
And do you have thoughts on a next step in your own research on this?
So in my research on this, one of the things that I'm really interested in learning more about is breaking down the differences between those who both perpetrate and experience violence as a victim, thinking about the kind of tailored services that folks might need in that situation. So it's one of the things that research tells us is that the kind of worst health outcomes that are associated with being involved in violence, both as a perpetrator and a victim. So understanding what the needs might be there.
Tova, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tova Walsh is an assistant professor of social work and an affiliate of the Center for Child and Family Well-Being and the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. You can find links to the study that we've been talking about over at WPR.org. Coming up, the nation is looking back at past disease outbreaks to find lessons for today. We'll look back at the rise of AIDS, how it affected Wisconsin, and how the state reacted. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Economic output numbers for the U.S. from the year's second quarter showed a historic downturn. We'll look at the figures with an economics professor. First, every public health crisis is complex and requires its own unique set of responses, but there are patterns and parallels from one outbreak to another. In the early 1980s, the nation experienced the beginnings of what would later be known as AIDS. But the early years included a lot of confusion, misinformation, and missteps that meant more cases and more lives at risk. Former State Representative David Clarenbach is a Wisconsin Democratic politician and gay activist who served 9 terms in the Wisconsin State Assembly. He's featured in the WisContext piece, How AIDS Pushed Wisconsin to Change Its Approach to Public Health. When we spoke last month, I asked him what the view on the ground in Wisconsin was like when the then unknown and misunderstood disease was emerging in other parts of the country.
Well, it indeed seems like a long, long time ago, and a galaxy far, far away even. We took advantage of the early experiences of California and even New York City to try to devise some preemptive systems so that we would be better prepared in Wisconsin when the epidemic hit here. I always kind of described it as a time bomb that had not yet exploded. Most people, vast majority of people who were HIV positive had no idea that they were HIV positive. But I think we in Wisconsin, maybe some unique sets of circumstances here, we were able to make more progress than perhaps some other states.
What kind of concrete changes did you and your colleagues in the legislature advance at that time?
Really, the two most important things we were able to accomplish was the prohibition against discrimination based on HIV status. Of course, in the early time, it wasn't HIV, it was HTLV-3, that individuals could not be fired from their jobs, for instance, because they were HIV positive. And second, that we imposed some very strict privacy limitations on the disclosure of HIV test results. The potential for mass hysteria and the inherent homophobia that obviously still exists today but was rampant back then had a chilling effect on individuals' likelihood of getting tested. And just as with COVID today, really the key to the addressing the epidemic of AIDS is testing, testing, testing. And no one's going to get tested if they think they're going to lose their job as a result. So we put in, this was even before the HIPAA federal requirements on privacy. We worked very closely with the state epidemiologists, but also the medical society and the hospital association and even the insurance industry to try to set up some of these safeguards.
You were a Democrat in the assembly. Was there bipartisan cooperation to make these changes?
There was indeed, and that's what makes it such a different era. There was a sense of collegial respect. There was discussion and compromise. And I know that sounds pretty Pollyannish in today's world, but we couldn't have done what we did in those things in the AIDS field without bipartisan support. You know, Wisconsin was the first state to have a gay rights law to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation in employment, housing, or public accommodations. It was signed into law by a Republican governor, and the votes in both houses of the legislature, the margin of victory, were provided by Republican votes. So that, and in all of these AIDS legislation that we enacted, there were likewise bipartisan support, and that was crucial to remove the politics of it. I think we see today with the COVID pandemic, so much of the, whether you're going to wear a mask or get tested or how many tests we conduct, have become political fodder, and we were able to escape that to a large degree in Wisconsin because we thought ahead a few steps on how we might want to deal with the AIDS epidemic.
Talking to former Wisconsin State Assembly Representative David Clarenbach, looking back at how Wisconsin experienced and reacted to the rise of AIDS in the 1980s and beyond. A big question now, David, with COVID-19 has been, you know, whose job is it to take the lead? Is it the federal government, state, local, whatever? Looking back at AIDS, what did you see in the division of labor between what we heard from the federal government, what you were doing at the state level?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't really have much of a choice, as you perhaps may recall, or some people of my generation at least would recall, that the word AIDS was not spoken by President Reagan until several years after our efforts became law. The federal government was of virtually no value until the Ryan White Act provided some funds to the states. So we felt that we were kind of on our own. It was the Wild West days of epidemics. I mean, we had not had one for, I guess at that time, 70 or 80 years. And we were kind of running blind. So we tried to take some lessons from California and New York, but we also, I think, charted our own course to try to make the system of public health work without the kind of hysteria and the politicization of the disease. It's a healthcare issue. It's a public health crisis. It's not politics.
Do you think it's possible to recreate that today, given what you were talking about with the politicization of so many elements of COVID-19 that we have right now?
I don't know that it is possible. It's hard to put the genie back in the bottle. And I think our political discourse in general terms seems so poisoned today. And even on an issue like this, where there's not the stigmatization that AIDS had, because after all, a vast majority at that time of people who were being infected were homosexuals. Now talk about a stigma. Today, there isn't even that kind of stigma with COVID-19 infections, yet it is far more political than AIDS ever was in Wisconsin. So I'm very discouraged, and I hope that we can come to our collective senses. I'm hopeful, but I'm not particularly optimistic.
David, we had a caller call in and mention that they thought the state did a good job of getting education in schools so kids could understand what was going on. Can you talk about that, the educational outreach efforts we saw in Wisconsin?
Well, the administration of Governor Tony Earle was very aggressive in establishing a task force on AIDS and HIV infection. And it was composed of not only experts in the field, epidemiologically speaking, but also people who were openly gay and educators. And public hearings were held around the state to try to ease the discussion into the school system. And you're absolutely right. That was one of the keys for our success with respect to AIDS. You know, there was even a member of the, I think, school board in Racine or Kenosha who was opposed to having gay teachers in schools, much less education about AIDS or HIV infection, because that gets so close to sex education in schools. And there's still a lot of opposition to things like that. But we did have a much more open and more progressive approach to the public health crisis and education of the citizenry, which out of necessity must begin before the age individuals become sexually active.
In our last few moments, David, can you share a lesson you think we should be learning today on COVID-19 from the rise of AIDS?
Well, I do hope that when we do come to our senses, that we recognize that this is part and parcel of a slightly broken healthcare system, and that we have not had in place the kind of rigorous testing or even the personal protective equipment necessary to treat people who are sick with COVID-19. And that would be the lesson that I would hope that we would learn. That is, to be proactive and anticipate the needs before they hit us in the face.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was former State Representative David Klarenbach, a Wisconsin Democratic politician and gay activist who served 9 terms in the Wisconsin State Assembly. I talked to him last month, and you can find the WisContext article, How AIDS Pushed Wisconsin to Change Its Approach to Public Health. You can find that over at wiscontext.org. While you're there, check out a lot of great reporting, often very data-rich, on the latest news in Wisconsin when it comes to COVID-19 testing and efforts to turn the tide against the disease. Think of some of the most iconic album covers you've ever owned or seen. Depending on which generation you come from, it might be the Queen album with the four band members in that diamond formation. A Michael Jackson's Bad could be Taylor Swift or Bruce Springsteen. Well, now there's a take on some of those covers from a nursing home in the UK. As reported by NPR, the staff and residents at the Sidmar Lodge Care Home in Edgware, England, have been dealing with COVID-related lockdowns like care facilities around the world. But they've come up with a cool project to make the most of their time. Residents have been sitting for photo shoots with wardrobe, hair, and makeup done by staff and created some of those famous album covers, recreated them. A resident named Lily, for example, turns a Madonna album into a Liliana album. A 93-year-old resident named Vera fills in for Adele. There's a Bowie, a Michael Jackson, some Elvis Costello and The Clash, and yes, all four members of Queen, played by staff members at the care center. On top of the fun, residents there selected three charities and set up a funding page using their album cover renditions to raise money for those groups. Now the question is, which album cover could I recreate? Maybe get a few friends together for Abbey Road, because that's a good social distance option, and it's outdoors. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.